我が弟に加勢を求める使いを送り、その後大坂に攻め上って敵を一掃いたす。時は来た。えい、えい。
Welcome to Shogun, the official podcast. I'm Emily Yoshida, and I was a writer on the series. And each week, after every episode, I'll be diving deeper into the biggest twists and behind-the-scenes stories from the FX series with co-creators Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo, along with the cast and crew that helped bring this story to life. This week, we're talking about Episode 6, The Women of the Willow World. So this is a quick heads up that there will be spoilers for this and the previous five episodes. On the podcast today, I'll hear about what it took to film the sexiest scene in the whole series with director Hiromi Kamada, what was in a name for both highborn and lowborn people in the Sengoku period with historian Frederick Krenz, and the scene so haunting that it found its way into Anna Sawai's dreams. But first, let's talk about the flashback at the top of this episode and how the real history informed the story of Ochiba and Mariko.
I think it was all about getting experts in Japan to weigh in. We really needed to get people who had primary sources.
This is Callan Puente. Callan had many jobs over the course of Shogun's creation: research coordinator, writer, and producer.
So we get to see a little bit of their childhood, of Mariko and Ochiba's childhood, and they're both loosely inspired by their historical counterparts. We get to kind of see them at this turning point in history where we've had approximately 200 years of civil war at this point, and all these different feudal lords who are vying for power. And Ochiba's father, Kuroda, in history would have been her uncle, was the first warlord to be able to unite the country and almost take control. And we're stepping in a fictional moment where these two girls would have been growing up together. They're hearing everything that their fathers are saying, and we're seeing this really powerful event of Mariko's father betraying his lord and ending what would be this dynasty that he was trying to create.
But it's a really interesting situation because I think both historically, maybe, and also in the context of Shogun, our story, it was not an unpopular action, I guess. Can you kind of explain some of that honor, the reputation thing, even when it means assassinating a very unpopular person?
It's kind of recognizable from our point of view today as history is written by the victor. Like, if her father had been successful, then it would have been a completely noble act because there were a lot of horrible, violent things that he did. But because Mariko's father betrayed his lord and then was only successful for a few days, he was not the victor. And I think he is like looked upon as this like horrible traitor. But I think it is a little bit more complicated, and we see like the way that Torinaga reacts to it exemplifies it. Like, he's not looking down on Mariko's family with shame. And there's some interesting historical records from Hasekawa Gracia's husband, where the historical model for the Taiko invited her to his chambers, essentially. And he was like, "You should not invite my wife. She said if she was invited to your chambers, she would kill you," to redeem her father, essentially. So she carried this with her, just like Mariko did through her whole life, and was very convinced of her father's honor and that he was doing the right thing. And for Mariko personally, I think we can see that really impacting her more in how she perceived her failure of duty. Like, if she was able to live up to her father, it was less that she was ashamed that she was from a traitor's family, but more that she didn't think that she did right by him and dying with her mother and her siblings.
You know, it also comes to bear in her relationship with Buntaro, and there's the emotional abuse, there's physical abuse. We've seen him be like quite monstrous to her, and we kind of get a bigger picture of exactly what this rift is between them and how it kind of also stems from that same conflict.
In terms of Mariko and Buntaro's relationship, there's so much. There's a lot of history that's been passed down and turned a little bit more into legend, so we're not exactly sure how true certain things are, but there's so many anecdotes about their relationship and about this violence between them, about the tension, a lot of this stemming from her conversion to Christianity and her family's past and his relationship with that. But there is like a very interesting story called The Snake and the Ogre, where there's a gardener who's like working for them who is looking at Hosokawa Gracia and Tadayoki, who's the historical model for Buntaro, is notoriously very, very jealous, and he kills this man for looking at her, and he wipes the blood from his sword on her kusode, and she doesn't change her expression and just continues to wear the same clothes for 3 days in a row without saying anything, acting like it's completely normal until he loses it and apologizes to her. And she changes her clothes, and he explodes and says that you're a snake. And she says, a snake is an appropriate wife for an ogre. And that is like the legend of their relationship.
Gosh. So we've kind of been teasing out Ochiba little by little over the course of the series. And, you know, we first meet her in the flashback at the beginning of two. And she's somebody who comes with such a reputation before her. How do you think about the character of Ochiba as far as what she represents both as like a woman in this story, as a political figure? What was it important for you always to make sure we understood about Ochiba from the moment we met her?
I think that it's really useful in this episode that we meet Ochiba and Mariko when they're children and we see this evolution of her character along with Mariko, because we are kind of keeping her at arm's length compared to how much of Mariko's interiority that we're getting. And with Ochiba, I think this really helps us understand the mask that she's created, that she's like had to create because of the position she's in, stemming from her father being this controversial, really violent warlord to all the people who are trying to control her in her life. We don't always have access to her intentions. And we see just this meticulously crafted facade that she has worked really hard to put in place to maintain some sort of control and power in her life. So I think that getting to see that evolution, even though we're not seeing all of it, we don't know fully what's behind it yet. I think that is really important to like understand about her, is so much of her effort is going into this facade. But I do think we kind of discount some of the women in this time period. And she is a really interesting example of someone who historically and in the show had like a really significant political sway. She's probably the most powerful woman in Japan at this time and will continue to be for a while in history.
Seeing these two characters as children not only gives us new insights into the women they become, it also had a profound effect on how the actors saw their roles.
I already had the story in my head, but seeing the girls shoot, it really changed something within me.
Back to talk through the big reveals of Mariko's backstory in this episode is the actor who played her, Anna Sawai.
I guess the idea of duty became a little more vivid, and the connection that I had with the actress that plays Fumi, it felt real. Yeah. And it felt bittersweet as I was doing it. I know that I probably shouldn't have had those bittersweet emotions because Mariko wouldn't know what's going to happen in the future. But it was all real. And it even haunted me in my dreams. So I have a friend who I was really close with in elementary school to middle school. And for some reason, we got out of touch. And, you know, I didn't really think too much about it. But I had a dream the day before I shot with Fumi that I was asking that friend, like, whatever happened to us. And I was, like, so sad. I woke up crying. And I think seeing those two girls play Mariko and Ruri, it really shaped the scenes that were about to happen.
Do you feel like there was some moment in which the politics that they're both surrounded in and the way they're kind of being used as pawns, was there a moment that you feel like that dawned on her?
I think the day of the marriage when Mariko is sent off is when she has to kind of come to terms with it. And we see that Mariko's not okay and Duty is trying to help her accept her fate. That is kind of the goodbye because they're no longer together and they have their own separate ways to go forward.
So also in six, we have a sequence I think everybody remembers from this episode, the tea house visit with Mariko and Blackthorn. And this scene, you know, Blackthorn and Mariko have already, you know, been intimate together, but this feels like a completely different way for them to connect and have a moment together. And it's very unconventional, I think, when we think of Hollywood love scenes or something like that. What's going through Mariko's mind in that whole scene?
I think she was in denial of everything that had happened. She wanted to kind of forget everything, restart. She's only here as a translator. But she also knows that this is a test. She knows that Toranaga has an idea and he has people watching her. Or at least she feels that way from Gin and Kiku. And so I think she's very cautious, but through Kiku and her words, she's able to tell Blackthorn what she wishes but otherwise could not. And I don't even think that she expects it. And so as she's saying it, she's realizing everything that she's feeling. But it's also so interesting because when I was playing it, that's kind of what I was focusing on. But when I saw it, it felt like so much more was going on in her head. Like she's kind of taken to the past for a moment and she's realizing her purpose. And she's like, no, like I can't do this. I must leave right now before it's too late. So I love the way that they edited it because now I think it's all up to the audience and how they interpret it.
Torunaga reveals to Mariko that her marriage was basically a way for her to be saved from this rebellion and from, you know, the fate that the rest of her family faces. And it feels like this is very much a kind of pattern of people making decisions for people to save them when it may or may not be in the end what they want. How does this information change the way Mariko sees her fate or, you know, sees her situation?
I think that up until this point, she really didn't understand why she couldn't follow her father. She didn't understand why her father had married her off right before this. Not that he knew that this was going to happen, but she feels like there's no meaning in her living. Mm-hmm. But knowing that her father intentionally made her marry Buntaro to save her life so that she can keep continuing his fight impacts her immensely. And I think from this point on, her will to get this done is just unbreakable. Like she knows what she's doing and she is just running for that after this.
I like the relationship between Torunaga and Mariko a lot. It feels very nuanced. There's so much respect there and just so much history as well.
Yeah.
What was your kind of acting relationship like with Sanada-san? And yeah, what was it like doing your scenes with him?
I feel like it's kind of similar to Torunaga-sama and Mariko. I felt like he really took care, like he took care of me so well because he knew that it was my first period piece. He also showed me that he wanted the best for me so that it would serve this whole show. I really felt like I could go to him at any time and he would have my back. I think Torunaga-sama is a lot more serious than Hiro is. Hiro can be very, very, very friendly and he likes to crack jokes and he's always making everyone kind of smile. And it was nice to have that because Shogun can be very serious and Japanese people are so professional and there's not a lot of joking around unless someone like Hiro starts.
The flashback to Ruri and Mariko's childhood gives us a bit more insight into the mysterious Lady Ochiba. But who was Yodo no Kata, the historical figure who inspired her? Before she would become Yodo no Kata, a very young Azai Chacha found herself wrapped up in conflict. At just 4 years old, she would be caught in a violent three-year war between her father and forces led by Oda Nobunaga. When her father finally found himself without the hope of a victory, he committed seppuku, and ultimately this led to Chacha's placement under the protection of Nobunaga, the very man who had defeated her father. But Nobunaga himself was killed just years later by Akechi Mitsuhide, who was the real-life inspiration for Mariko's father. And after that, both Chacha and her mother were married into the family of yet another nobleman. And when that nobleman clashed with the Taiko, aka the most powerful man in Japan at the time, Chacha became one of his concubines, the only one who was able to give him a son and heir. But when the Taiko died, as we saw in episode 2 of Shogun, the raising of the heir to Japan fell to Chacha, now called Yodo no Kata, which made her one of the most powerful women in Japanese history. What she does with this power, though, remains to be seen, at least in our story. While Ochiba and Mariko find themselves on opposite sides of a brewing war in this episode, two other women in a very different corner of Japanese society come into focus, the women of the Willow World.
It was a mixture of entertainment, like playing the shamisen, dancing, and so on.
Historian Frederick Krins returns to help us understand the role of courtesans during the Sengoku period.
This part of the show was one of my favorites because now we have that idea of the geisha. It's a typical Japanese geisha. But at the time, geishas weren't existing yet. And it was the start of what would later become the geisha culture. So they had a function of entertainment. So it was not just a brothel as such. It was much more than that. It was totally a community of women. So the courtesans, of course, were women, but also the leader of the group, which was Gin here, were women. And at the end of the Sengoku period, this started to change. First, it became more institutionalized, while in the Sengoku period, there was much more freedom and the women were much more independent. And you can get some colorful people, colorful figures like Gin or Kiku.
So I had a question about something that was always really interesting to me while we were writing the show, which was the names of the characters. We've seen several characters by now who've had different names growing up and then changed them, like Ochiba. And I've noticed that consorts and wives have no kata added to their names, like Kiri no kata and Ochiba no kata. Then there are some like Kiku or Gin who exist in a different social class and obviously have very different kinds of names. So how did people choose their names, or who chose them?
Well, in the Sengoku period, how you say, it's not that you have an administration, a country, and everyone is registered by name. So everyone was quite free to use the names they wanted to say. If you have persons, very highly ranked women at the time, it was not polite to utter their names. So they had to use a euphemism. And mostly they used the place where they lived. And no kata means the direction. So it's really a euphemism. It's the person who lives there. For example, if you take Ochiba, Ochiba means fallen leaves. Mm. So it could be that the room where she lives was called the room of the fallen leaves. And that's why they call her Ochiba no kata, the lady who lives in the room of the fallen leaves.
There's so much fun history in this episode. We also get to see a little bit of the no theater when Ochiba and Nishigo go to try to find their new regent. And was this the most dominant form of entertainment at the time? Was this just how you would spend your afternoon if you were a noble person in Osaka?
No theater was enormously popular among the samurai class. And you have Hosokawa Fujitaka, who is a model for Hiromatsu. He wrote in a poem, if I recall, so poetry, linked verse poetry, no theater. These are the things that a samurai has to the skills for. That makes a real samurai. You have Lord Ito performing perfectly possible. A lot of warlords, they learned to perform no, and they really loved it. And the most famous of them all was the Taiko, Hideyoshi. He was really crazy about no, and he let compose, I think, 10 no plays about himself, which he performed himself too. So that's what this no play was based on. It was Akechi Uchi, so the slaying of Akechi. It's the same as what Hideyoshi played 400 years ago.
And for those who have maybe not seen no perform before and are seeing it for the first time in the show, you know, I think maybe a Western audience is more familiar with Kabuki.
Kabuki was already played in the Sengoku period, but it was played by courtesans. No theater was really for the elites, for the samurai. And it evolved, even in the Edo period, it continued in its old way. I think Kabuki has changed very much from the Sengoku till the Edo period, but no hasn't changed that much. It's still played nowadays as greatly as it was in the Sengoku period.
As Frederick said, the no theater one can see in Japan today is largely unchanged from the style one would have seen in a court of the Sengoku period. While this means we had access to plenty of reference materials, it also meant that there was the pressure to honor this long-held tradition.
I felt blessed because my father would be for the first time proud of something I directed. No, kidding.
This is Hiromi Kamada, the director of episode 6. For her, this was one sequence that she wanted to get absolutely right.
The no theater, it was a privilege as a Japanese Mexican, you know, the daughter of a Japanese man, to be able to witness a no play in, you know, I've never seen one, you know, live, and to have the honor of capturing it. It was one of the highlights of my career for sure. It was a big responsibility, no, because we were all really, and this is one thing that the whole show was, you know, was very cautious with, was respecting, no, every single aspect and being as accurate possible in terms of culture and history, and also make the scene work, which is a very complicated scene, no? It's a political thriller, plotting kind of moment where everyone is suspecting about everything. And then you have this wonderful, beautiful, exquisite play happening while this whole scene is happening.
So from what I understand, the play that we see in the show is inspired by an actual no play from that time period. But in the show, we also see that it depicts the Taiko essentially meeting and wooing and marrying Ochiba. It's like their love story. So what do you think is going through Ochiba's head as she watches this highly stylized retelling of her own life?
I think what she's thinking is, man, it wasn't like that. You know, like, it wasn't romantic. It wasn't beautiful. It was painful. It was dark. It was life-changing. And you can see it, no? There's a beautiful shot of Fumi as we're pushing into her face, and all these things are happening inside of her as she watches. Fumi is one of the actresses that I've work with, that her range is so wide. She's just a monster at what she does. She's a beast, you know, she's incredible. And she really has the talent to do an emotional striptease while she's shooting a scene. So we were very clear about how many layers are we letting go and how many layers are we keeping in. How protected is she? How much she let her guard down at this specific moment? And it was a wonderful analogy because the more powerful that woman is, she wears more layers on her costume, no? On the way she dresses. Yeah. And Ochiba, especially on the no theater, I think she was wearing like 5 or 6 layers, something like that. So we kind of thought about it conceptually as layers.
So another big piece in this episode is at the tea house in Ajiro with Kiku and Gin. And thinking about her kind of in contrast with Ochiba, and Kiku also in contrast with Ochiba, is women from very different classes that still kind of made their destiny. In a way, were you kind of thinking about building both of those storylines together, or kind of having them comment on each other like that?
What I always think about on this episode is the ladies of the willow world. No, it's the title of the episode. How they're all behind this fence, but they wish they live there in this place where they can be themselves, where they can have agency. No, the whole theme of the show that I really love is that dual relationship between agency and entrapment. No, and every woman on the episode is fighting that. There's this wonderful speech almost at the end of the episode by Mariko where she says, a woman is simply at war, right? And they're all at war because they're all fighting. They all have something to fight for. Ochiba is fighting, you know, to get revenge, to avenge her father, to get back at Toranaga, and she's on it. Mariko has a purpose, has a mission. She needs to finish her father's mission and be Toranaga's ally until the very end and let go of her feelings for Blackthorn. She has a bigger purpose than that. Kiku, she wants a career. She wants to be the best courtesan. Yes, she's in love with Omi. She has feelings for him, but she cannot give in to that because there's something bigger. Gin, the future of her business, you know. So all of them, they have a secret war going on. And it was very interesting to see in different scenes with each different characters how they all had to keep alive that battle, no, inside of them.
And especially Mariko's battle to kind of sort of resist the charms of Blackthorn, I guess. The tea house scene between them is really kind of, I mean, there's a lot going on there. What was that kind of like, you know, coordinating this sort of very unconventional love scene?
It was a huge challenge, I must say. Mm-hmm. Why? Because it had to be, in the words of Mr. Justin Marks, the sexiest scene on the show. And there's no physical contact, right?
Yeah.
So how do you build that? How do we make it sexy there? So everything around them had to be sexy. I made Anna watch Bergman's Persona and In the Mood for Love. I tortured Cosmo, making him watch again and again Remains of the Day. Because what was important is what's left unsaid. It's all in their connection. Yeah. It's all in the way they look at each other. It's all in that beautiful moment where, you know, Mariko eclipses Kiku on her translation. And she kind of gets possessed. She gets pulled into the moment, into the confession. And everything that she's saying is way more sexier than anything I could have shot I gotta give it to Anna. She did a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful job on this scene, really, honestly.
So this is, like we've been talking about, an episode that very much focuses on our main female characters in the episode. But I think all of the themes that we've been talking about are obviously things that go back to Toranaga. And the end of this episode, we get this declaration of Crimson Sky, this big sort of this attack that they've kind of been keeping up the sleeve for a while on Osaka, this sort of last-ditch plan. Where do you see Toranaga as he comes to this decision?
My two favorite card players of Shogun are Ochiba and Toranaga. Every single piece that he moves has to do with something that's coming in the future. I think he's kind of in a corner now. His choices are limited to basically none, like to strike on Osaka Castle, and that's all he has. And we gave ourselves license not to make that ending muscular. It's the prelude to a big battle, to a big changing. We'll see what happens in the next episode. But yes, we wanted to end it on that note. Something big is about to happen, and Toranaga made a decision.
I've heard a lot of stories from this set about just how deeply multicultural it is, multilingual and all of that. And, you know, all the kind of different layers of communication that are going on. It's just so impressive. Did you have any favorite stories from on set or stuff from behind the scenes that you remember?
At my monitors, you know, there was this little tent where I had the monitors and I had my wonderful Japanese script supervisor, Katsu, and we had the wonderful Canadian supervisor who was Irene, and I had Galin Puente with me all the time. She was, you know, the writer on set with me, producer as well. Mm-hmm. And we had Elise, the trainee AD. So all of us ladies inside that tent, we were shorter than 5'1". So it was like this miniature little tent, you know, where all these short women, but powerful women were... We're locked in. So we used to call it the 5'1 club. And Kalin even made, you know, sweatshirts about it. So we basically forbid anyone taller than that to step into the tent.
That's all for this week's episode of Shogun, the official podcast. Next week, with Ochiba's plan in motion, will tensions in Osaka reach a breaking point? How will Blackthorn and Mariko reckon with their impossible attraction to one another? And what will the declaration of Crimson Sky mean for Team Toranaga? Tune in next week when we discuss Episode 7 of FX's Shogun. You can find a link in our description to Episodes 1 through 6 of Shogun. And if you want to dive deeper into the world of our story, check out the official Shogun Viewer's Guide. There's a link to that in our show notes as well. Be sure to rate, review, and follow Shogun, the official podcast, wherever you listen. I'm Emily Yoshida, and I'll see you next week.